we were just talking about ice ages a little bit, and I was just commenting on how a planet has to start being considered as a living creature also, that it also has to go through evolutions just like every other life form inside of creation. This will be kind of an eye-opener for a lot of people, but that's what ice ages are all about. This gives the ability of the planet to go through its sleep state. All forms of spirit forms of all types in creation go through a wake and a sleep period. We go through a death cycle. That's our sleep period. The planet can't disappear and go into a fine matter world, so it has an ice age. An ice age is a deep sleep that the planet goes into. At first, the first time, a few times it happens on a planet, the whole planet is covered with ice. And then it becomes less and less as it goes on. Eventually it evolves up to the point where it doesn't need to do hardly that at all, because the planet starts being covered by higher evolved life forms. The planet itself then only has ice ages in areas generally where it's not harmful to the life forms. But each time it goes through an ice age, all of the plants, animals, and even humans are affected by this, and it's a way of pushing up their evolvement. So everything evolves to a little higher state. A plant will come back as a more beautiful plant. A tree will evolve into something nicer. Even the animal kingdom, like a mammoth. A mammoth evolved into being an elephant. Now, ice ages on Earth are every 700,000 years for the major ice age. This is because there's a rhythm to how the ice ages work. People into biorhythms will probably pick up on this right away. I'm unfortunately don't understand that real well. But I do know that, as she's explaining it, the natural numeric system of the creation is based on sevens. And consequently, the rhythm, the natural rhythm of our planet is 700,000 years for these major ice periods to happen. At that time right now, they're covering 1/6 to 1/4 of our planet. We've had 4 major ice ages the last 2,800,000 years. That's the amount of surface area that was covered during each one of those. There are also interglacial periods between those 700,000 years. These come about every 350,000 years, and they are much smaller. They cover only about 1/10 to 1/12 of the planet. So there's been a total of 12 seeming ice periods in the last 2,800,000 years. The next interglacial period, it will be in about 150,000 years. We also have things called glacial wandering or glacial shifting, which the rhythm for that is much faster. They come about every 70,000 years, and this can confuse scientists a little bit when they're trying to pinpoint when the next ice age may actually come. So all of these periods have their own rhythms, and they're all corresponding to the 7x7 numeric nature of the creation itself. Okay? Billy raised another question about Pope Paul VI, and who he had been told earlier would be poisoned and is dead, but at the time he was still in office. And so he was, of course, kind of concerned about that. And he said, I thought she's supposed to be dead. And Semyasa remarked that he is, that actually the chairs, the cardinals of Rome, who control the popes, had, through association with the Jewish Zionist extremists, poisoned Pope Paul VI. The man who was then looking like Pope Paul VI was an imposter, and that actually they had found someone that looked like him, done some alterations to make him look like it. They'd even gone to the problem of erasing the birth certificates, school papers, and all the records they could find of the original Pope Paul VI to hide what they had actually done, so people really wouldn't recognize or ask any questions that might cause problems. Billy wanted to know if there was any life on any other planets, again, in our system. She said, no. And he said, well, how about extraterrestrial bases on Jupiter? She said, no. But on the moon called Ganymede, there was an extraterrestrial base there. That extraterrestrial base was founded and operated by the Bafath intelligence. And again, the Bafath intelligence is also sometimes called the Giza intelligence, because these were the beings, the extraterrestrial beings, who were hiding out below the Great Pyramid of Giza and have tried to cause Billy so many problems. Another interesting note, we talked earlier about Saint Germain, this guy Rokoski that lived as the man Saint Germain, who was kind of a trickster, magician, and fraud. We're going to talk more about reincarnation and life cycles later on, but she pointed out to Billy that he has reincarnated. He's not aware of it, but the man who was once thought of as being Saint Germain is now reincarnated in a new life. He was born in Bohemia, and he is now known as Prince Roger de Polaski, and he lives in Germany. And Billy was just kind of knocked out by this because they were able to track this guy, watch his new life cycle, see him be born as a different individual, and he wanted to go meet him and just, I guess, to check him out. And Semyonovsky remarked, no, stay away from him because he's just as deceitful, just as much of a fraud. It's just as much of a wasted life as it was in his previous life when he was Saint Germain. So Billy never made really any attempt to find the guy. There was a question about the White Brotherhood. They say that there are spiritual centers that they are in control of or are using the forces of, places in like in Peru and the Andes, a place called Meru, M-E-R-U. There's another place in Uxmal in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico outside of the city of Merida, if you've ever been out there. And there's a place, the Royal Teton in Wyoming, and a place called Boff in Canada. And Billy wanted to know if these centers were actually places where their spiritual powers were talking to people. Okay, that's what the White Brotherhood apparently says. And she says, no, this is total nonsense, that the White Brotherhood, being a very powerful organization, has a lot of old knowledge. And she says they are aware of, I guess you could call it a mind trick, where you can have a large group of people concentrate their thoughts on one particular spot. Like, say you get 1,000 people together and you want them all to concentrate on one particular exact location. What happens is, she says, when all of their thoughts actually do converge on that one location, there's kind of a block of energy that forms right there, and it causes a reflection or an echo that bounces back to the person who's sending the thought. And they perceive that, they're confused, they somehow think that they're being spoken to by a spiritual entity. They're not. It's just their own thoughts bouncing off this block where the convergence is. Unfortunately, apparently the White Brotherhood uses some sort of trick to get people to follow them or whatever. There's another question about the drive system of the beam ships. That was asked earlier, and she reiterated, yeah, that the old beam ships, as they were called, worked on kind of a light bundling system. Bundle is the word that they use, but they haven't built those for about 400 years. When Billy took the first pictures of Semyonovsky's ship, that was a beam ship. It worked on that light principle. And those ships give off some amount of radiation. And she isn't using that ship any longer. She had a new ship. Her new ship used an anti-gravity drive, and it was based on a different principle of dischargement, whatever dischargement means. She says this ship had this anti-drive was used for planetary drive, and they used a tachyon drive in space. And she says it's based on faster-than-light particles that, as our scientists learn to understand them, will begin to name them tachyons. The present ship that she was in at that time for the contact, she says, has a different kind of drive system. It's called an antimatter drive. By the way, that ship weighs 1.5 tons, she said. Billy was kind of surprised, and he says, you mean antimatter actually exists? She says, oh, sure. There is an entire antimatter world, as she'd explained to him once before. There are even parallel universes. So in the antimatter, I don't know that there are worlds in the antimatter world, that there is. They just said there's an antimatter world and did not really define more about it, except that there's an immense amount of energy that somehow can be pulled out of this antimatter dimension or world, whatever it is. Billy was intrigued with Quetzal's name and said it sounds a lot like Quetzalcoatl of the old South American folk stories, and was there any relation? And she said, no, not at all. The Quetzalcoatl was the old times, was a very high officer actually in Egypt, and he took upon a special mission to go to South America, to the land of the Aztecs. And when he went from Egypt to South America, he had a small spacer ship, and when he landed with his spacer ship, of course, it was very impressive with the local Aztecs, and they regarded him as a god and a great leader. But he ran into another man there, similar to himself, of great power, which I can't begin to pronounce. It's spelled Huitzilopochtli. So I guess that would be like Huitzapochtl or something. Anyway, a battle ensued between these two powerful people, and Quetzalcoatl lost out. Somehow intrigues got too strong and forced him out of South America, and he returned to Egypt. But that's where the legends stem from. Billy wanted to know about Great Atlantis, that he was not satisfied with the first explanation that, yes, it did exist. He wanted to know a little bit more about it. She says, okay, she liked to talk about that, that actually there were two Atlantises. There was the great continent of Atlantis, which spread the land barrier between the Americas and all the way over to Europe and Africa. That was originally founded by a Vega man named Atlantis. His wife's name was Caratide. Her father's name was Muras. He founded the continent of Mu, which was in the Gobi Desert in China. But there were two Atlantises. There was the great continent there. His wife, Caratide, started like a smaller colonization of Atlantean people in the area we now think of as the Mediterranean Sea, around the Santori Islands, or Santori area right in there. And she says what happened was that when Atlantis finally fell during the Great Wars, that small Atlantis lived on for almost 6,000 years, some of the people who survived that. But there came a time, when, which was 3,500 years back, when the great destroyer comet came close to Earth, had Venus in tow. It once again had pulled Venus out of its orbit, and it came close enough to the planet that it caused great destruction here on Earth. Mostly, at the side of the planet, the Mediterranean side, was facing the great comet when it went by, and it pulled all the water up out and caused waves up to 200 meters high, flooded all over Egypt, Crete, and Syria. Volcanoes erupted, the ocean floor was broken loose, and most of those small islands, the Santori Islands, sunk below the sea, and most of the inhabitants that had survived there in Little Atlantis died out. Crete at that time was called Minoa, M-I-N-O-A. Descendants of Atlantis, they survived there, but most of the islands were gone. So there was mainly two Atlantis colonizations, the very large one and the small one started by his wife, Caratide. Mu, on the other hand, was a colony of Lyrians, and there was a city under Mu in the Gobi Desert, and that's where Agharta was and still is. Actually, there are two Agharta cities. There's a large one, Agharta A, and there's a smaller one that's connected by a tunnel called Agharta B. Apparently, it was like just a rural outgrowing or something. Each city, they're independent. Each one has a man and a woman who are the leaders of those cities. Billy had a question about extraterrestrials and Earth people about dying and being able to go to another planet. He wanted to know if an extraterrestrial died, say, for on his own planet somewhere out in space, could he somehow then be born here on Earth, or vice versa, could someone die here on Earth and then cause themselves to be reborn on another world, like a Pleiadian world or something? She says, no, this is not possible. The part of the fixed laws or truths, the way creation operates, is that the physical body and the spirit body are bound to the planet when they die. When you pass on, your spirit is somehow connected to this planet body that it's on through some force of nature, and it's not possible. If you want to die and be born on another planet, I suggest what you do is you get a ride on a beam ship, you go to another planet, as soon as they open the door, and you walk out on the other planet, kill yourself somehow so you can die on another planet, and then you'll come back on that other planet. That's about the only way it's going to happen. So there's really no truth to these stories we're hearing about people claiming that they're going to die and they're going to ascend to another dimension and that they're going to go on and live on another planet. It's just not possible. There was a question about colors and levels of consciousness, and this is an area I don't understand too much, but for those of you who do, I'm familiar with colors in meditation, when you sink into meditation, but there are colors related to the level of consciousness, and they are called the radiation values, is what the Pleiadians call them. They don't mean too much to me, but I will put in the exhibits, I'll put a page in there listing all of the numbers, the colors, and what they mean. And they are somehow related to our levels of consciousness. So those of you who are into that, you may find that interesting. Just roughly, the first value is pink. Number two value is violet. Three value is green. Four is goldenrod, golden red. Five is golden. Six is white. And seven is blue. Questions about disease were asked, and Semyasa remarked, yeah, on the Pleiadian worlds they have some disease. They still have diseases that they get from other worlds. Some still affect their society here and there, but for the most part they're pretty much disease-free. They have learned, for the one thing, that most diseases, almost all of them, are created and caused by the way we think. And on their world now, there's a far more balanced way of thinking, so they're not prone to disease to begin with. They do occasionally still catch colds and flus, things like that, which can happen to you. As far as cancer and some of our more dreaded disease, they didn't have those diseases. They were aware of how one way it might be possible to cure them through force of spirit, but she would not comment on that because she said to reveal that would reveal certain powers of the mind that we really weren't ready to understand yet, and it's better that we discover and evolve towards these on our own. One of their very serious levels of morality is that they are not allowed to interfere with our personal right to evolve on our own path of evolution. And in areas where the answers to questions actually would do that, they don't. They refuse to offer us information that would interfere with our own discovery. Again, it goes back to each person has his own truth, and everybody's on his own path of evolution. So we all have to go out and discover things for ourselves, and most importantly, we have to make it part of our life, or it just doesn't count. Billy had an interesting question, and I'll get more into this later on the Emmanuel tapes, but as you'll find out later on those tapes, Billy actually travels back in time and meets Emmanuel, and Emmanuel leaves something for him in the future, which Billy does find later on. That turns out to be a piece of foil, and what looks like metal foil. And Billy has taken that to the Max Planck Institute in Munich for testing to see if there was something unusual about it. Well, apparently that the foil was some sort of combination of sulfur, carbon, oxygen, and hydrogen peroxide. It appears to be calcium sulfate or gypsum. They tried burning a little bit of it. There was no smell, and it just turned to a white powder. And he wanted to know what was the origin of this almost unusual little substance, not so different than what things we have here, but where did it come from? Semyasi told him that that was a present given to Emmanuel when he was 7 years old by his real father, who is Gabriel, a flesh and blood human being from the Pleiades. That Emmanuel, there was no, I guess you call it immaculate conception. Mary was impregnated by Gabriel, and there was a normal childbirth, and Emmanuel was born just like any other living flesh and blood human being. There was no magic involved there. His father was Gabriel, a physical man, and this was a present given to Emmanuel when he was 7 years old. It was kind of like a keepsake, and it came from a planet called Alcyon. And Billy was a little surprised because Semyasi mentioned at this time, she says, this is a keepsake, and Emmanuel was just trying to find a way to leave it for himself. Billy kind of paused because every now and then they kept insinuating that he was somehow either had been Emmanuel or was somehow connected with it. And he was having a lot of trouble with this because he had no recognition, really, at that time of ever having lived a life as Emmanuel. But there was constant reference to it throughout the notes, and when we get into the Emmanuel tape, I'll tell you the rest of the story. I wanted to tell you that whole story all in one run so we could get the whole thing in. One of the other really topical things that came up was the subject of abortion. Well, this was, she said, quite different on their world because their technology is so far more advanced. For instance, they can detect pregnancy within 3 days. Okay, so that being possible, then they can create or cause menstruation right away, and it washes it out so there's no life lost. They've also learned that the spirit actually inhabits the body within 3 weeks from the time of procreation, so that they've got a little extra time span there. So when our technology advances and we have the ability to actually detect pregnancy earlier, then that will be a great help. They also apparently put something in their food which stops pregnancy. So, whatever that might be, I don't know. That could be helpful for us. Okay, we're up to the 58th contact, which is on Monday, June 28th, 1976. So it's been going on now about a year and a half. Semyasi and Quetzal both come in a ship this time, and Billy wants to know if they would go ahead and land their ships on the ground. Typically, when the ship would come in for a contact, they would not sit down on the ground because they didn't want to leave any tracks. So Billy asked him if they would on this particular occasion. Quetzal agreed, and they set the ships down on the ground. And this, of course, when they do that, now the landing gear comes down, and the ship's on the ground, and the gravitational force in the ship makes an impression on the ground. And then once the ship is gone, it leaves three little nice rings down there going in a counterclockwise fashion. And you can see where the ship actually set down. Actually, what happened was the grass looks similar to like what a crop circle looks like, except they're smaller, of course. They're three round circles where the tripods of the ship set down. The grass is not broken. It's bent over, and it's growing the opposite direction of all the rest of the grass because it's no longer being controlled by the gravity of the planet. The gravitational force of the ship overcomes the gravity of the Earth for a period of time, causing the grass to grow the other direction. It doesn't break it, doesn't discolor it, and eventually it just grows back in when the gravity of the planet naturally overtakes it again. Well, on this particular trip, Billy had a surprise. Semyasi brought her sister along. Her name was Pleia, and he had an opportunity to not only meet her, but show her how to ride his moped. So he spent about 10, 15 minutes with her, and she asked him, you know, they didn't have much time today, but could she come back at some time and borrow his moped and go for a ride of her own? And she thought this was kind of wonderful fun, and Billy was making fun of us as being barbarians by riding around on these little bikes, and she thought that was kind of humorous. Billy had a question about life in the Centauri system. He had heard from different sources that there had been contacts by ETs from those areas and wanted to know if there was any truth to that. And Semyasi remarked, yes, it was, that there has been contact from beings from the Centauri system, that actually there was three groups of areas in Centauri that supported human life. Alpha Centauri, Beta Centauri, which is called the Barnard Star, and Proxima Centauri. 6 light-years away from Earth is the Barnard Star, and there is human life there that frequently makes contacts with us here on Earth. As a matter of fact, I think that Semyasi had some friends there and knew these people that were making contacts there. On the 60th contact, which was Thursday, July 2976, Billy had some questions of Semyasi if she would go over the dates and times of the great catastrophes that had befallen Earth. He was a little confused about the time period of the Great Flood, the falling of Atlantis, and a couple other events that the Destroyer Comet apparently was creating, and he wanted to get these straight. So she commented, of course, she'd go over these. She says, to begin with, the farthest back date that we'll start with was when Atlantis and Mu destroyed one another. Atlantis destroyed Mu, and Mu was able then to retaliate and actually destroy Atlantis. We went over this story just a little bit before. That was 11,498 years ago. Now, these years, these time periods, are all based on number of years back from the time they were talking, which in this case was 1976. She says, a very large planetoid came close to the Earth 10,215 years ago, and that divided the waters of the Atlantic Ocean, causing great flooding. Water ran over the Mediterranean area and up through northern Africa and into Europe. There was great problems then. The Destroyer Comet, of which they have mentioned several times and which has wreaked so much havoc on Earth, came by 10,080 years ago, causing severe flooding once again. Now, this comet comes around normally every 575 and a half years, but that cycle can vary. Sometimes it varies up to 200 years, but it always gets itself back on cycle, and if you average them out over a number of times, it still comes out to 575 and a half years. This Destroyer Comet came by again 7,957 years ago, and again came very close to the Earth, and there was volcanic action and flooding. It returned again 6,906 years ago, and there's even more flooding again. Apparently, every time it comes by, it's so huge, and the mass of this Destroyer Comet is so big, as I told you earlier, it's a very heavy, dense mass, and its gravitational force is so strong, it literally causes massive tidal waves in the ocean. Then there's a kind of a silence for a while until 3,453 years ago. The Destroyer comes by, and it is pulling Venus in tow. Now, Venus, as you may remember, was originally a moon of Uranus some years back, and 3,453 years ago was the final time that the Destroyer Comet affected the orbit of Venus and pulled it into the present orbit that it's in. Billy had a question, too, about the accuracy of the Bible, or if there might be documents that were more accurate than the Bible that we could rely upon historically. And she said, yes, the Sanskrit scribes are far more accurate historically because they haven't been changed at all. The Bible had been altered on several occasions because different power groups, societies, and kings and so forth have made slight alterations, good or bad, to serve their own interest, where the Sanskrit scripts had never been changed at all. They had never fallen prey to any power or leader that had altered them. Likewise, the original writings of Enoch and the Mayan calendar, she felt, were among the very most accurate pieces of information we could look to for historical data, and of the Mayan calendar for prophetic things that would happen in our future. As I mentioned before, Venus was originally a moon of Uranus. It was torn loose from Uranus 8,590 years ago. It pulled itself out of its orbit and went into a random orbit in our solar system. There, once again, 7,957 years ago, the comet once again was caught up by the destroyer comet as it passed through, and its orbit was changed again. Again, it was in sort of a random pattern in our solar system. Once more, 6,906 years ago, when the comet came through, it once again gave Venus a little tug, and Venus was running dangerously close to the Earth. 4,058 years ago, the orbit is changed once again as it closely comes by the planet Earth. And finally, 3,453 years back, Venus is finally towed into its current orbit. It swings around the sun very close and is greatly heated up. That's why it's hot today, and went into its current orbit. Velikovsky believes that possibly Venus came out of the planet Jupiter, but the Pleiadians are telling us different. Velikovsky's assumption is because he was trying to explain somehow how it got so hot. And because originally, as the Pleiadians say, it was a moon, an ice-covered moon, and when it swung around the sun, became very close, it was greatly heated up, and that's why it's hot today and in the orbit that it's in. Billy wanted a... also, by the way, the destroyer came by again in 1680, which wasn't that far back, and there are records, some astronomy records in Zurich, Switzerland, that certain astronomers did actually... make note of a very large comet that came through the solar system. It caused practically no damage at all. So there is some notation to support the idea that this destroyer comet is on the cycle that the Pleiadians are talking about. It will appear again, by the way, in the year 2255. It's its projected time to come around again. Wanting to clear up some terms, Sanyasi said that they call a sol system as a central sun. And when they speak of a sun system, that can be any planet that has three or more orbiting bodies around it. That would make Jupiter qualify, and any planet that has more than three moons circulating. Billy took some pictures of the landing tracks, and again, Sanyasi explained to them, you know, why the grass would look the way that it does. And Billy also took some friends with him out to see the landing tracks. At one point, during another occasion, the landing tracks were actually examined by UFO investigators who were on the scene, and it was found that there was some traces of gamma radiation in the landing tracks, as well as they found gamma radiation in Billy's rifle and his boots, and some of it actually got into his lungs somehow. Well, Billy is introduced to someone new. It appears that Sanyasi and Quetzal are planning on taking a holiday and returning back to the Pleiades for a period of time. And a lady named Manira is introduced to Billy because she will be Sanyasi's replacement while Sanyasi is gone. Well, Billy's in the beam ship with Sanyasi, and she's explaining this, and they're watching on the sight screen inside of the ship, and Sanyasi is telling Billy to watch that pretty soon we'll see Manira's ship coming in on the screen, that it's most unusual looking. It doesn't look anything like a beam ship. Apparently, it's not the saucer formation. It's some other unusual shape. Well, also, it doesn't have tripod landing legs either, so it's going to burn some holes in the ground later on that Billy can also take some rather good pictures of. Well, Manira lands and comes over into the ship, and they're speaking. Billy meets her. She looks much different than Sanyasi. She's a little shorter, about 10 centimeters shorter. She's very dark brown skin, kind of Jamaican sort of looking, with very dark hair. It's explained that she actually comes from a Vega planet, and the planet name is Duran, And she's going to fill in for Semyasi till the end of the year, which would be a period of about 3 months. Billy, as soon as he sees her, wants to know if there was any possible connection, because of her look, to the Hottentots of Africa. And she said, well, there is some. That her forefathers had come to Earth a long time ago and had mated with the Huns. And at that time, an offspring of that later developed, because the Huns then came together with the African natives that were there and created the Hottentots. So this, she said, was one of the original origins of her particular race through that intermixture. Billy noticed right away some unusual language going on that came to mind. He was curious about the different languages that they spoke. And he asked Semyasi, on the Pleiadian world, is there a name for the language that you speak? And she said, yeah, they call it Sarat, S-A-R-A-T. And they also know another language they call Kosan, K-O-S-A-N. And this was the Kosan language was a universal language that most all ETs and highly developed intelligences were aware of. And it was a universal language they could all communicate with each other. Manera's home language, from where she came from, was called Jenan, J-E-N-A-M. This was Manera's first time on Earth. So Semyasi is kind of commenting to Billy, take it easy on her, don't ask too many difficult questions, that she's here to help out a little bit, and don't make things too difficult for her. Just a quick aside here, on Good Friday on 1976 was a chance for Billy to actually record the sound of the ships. Normally they fly rather quiet. You can't hear anything except maybe a real faint kind of whining sound occasionally, because the protection screens around the ship hold the sound from going out, so you can't hear the thing. You can't see it, you can't hear it, you don't know if it's there. Well, Billy was driven out to the site by Hans Schutzbach, where he's going to record the sound. He gets his recorder out, he goes out into this open area, and he's just standing there with his hand up in the area, and Hans is way back over by the car. But even Hans can hear the sound clear over where he's standing. Hans doesn't get to see anything, which is a little frustrating for him. But he can see Billy out there, and Billy's waving. His hand is motioning, and the sound gets a little bit louder. And he records for about 10 minutes, and then he makes kind of a wild gesture for them to stop, and the sound goes away. He's told in later that the sound was caused by the rotation of the outer parts of the ship as it hits the air. So apparently something is spinning. I didn't know that the Pleiadian ships would spin, and I'm not so sure that they do. It might be energy kind of whirring around the outside of the ship or coming off of the ship. I'm not really sure about that. But it could be maybe the outer edge. There could be maybe on the ring on the outer edge of the ship, maybe something actually does spin. I'm really not sure about that. Anyway, one of the interesting things was that, again, apparently Billy had been followed. Because just as he's finishing up taking his sound recording, a car pulls up and there's a couple of police officers in it. Another car pulls up and it's, you know, somebody else. And suddenly there's like a half dozen people looking in the bushes and looking around to see what's going on with Billy. So he's having a very difficult time at this point going anywhere without being followed. Let's move forward now to the 63rd contact, which was Wednesday, September 22nd, 1976. A day after my birthday. My birthday is September 21st. Semyasi tells Billy that it's been a month or so that since she's seen him. She purposely stayed away because of his poor health. Apparently Billy's been sick. He's been in bed. He's gotten himself terribly run down, and he's not able to handle the work of his mission. And she kind of gets on him a little bit about that, because repeatedly they're telling him to be more careful with his health, not to overwork himself, that he's going to jeopardize the entire mission if he doesn't take a little better care of himself. So he kind of shakes his head, yeah, okay, yeah. Billy was never much one for taking care of himself, so it didn't mean much to him. On this particular landing, Manera's ship also comes in and sets down the way Billy asked and leaves a burn spot on the ground. So Billy wants to take a picture of that, and he finds out also the Manera's got a beam pistol, some sort of beam pistol, and he asks if he can also take a picture holding that. He thought that'd be great fun to take a picture holding the gun and then take a picture of a tree that he'd cut a tree down or shoot a hole in a tree or something. So they said, yeah, that would be possible that they would arrange for that. It was on this contact that Semyasi tells Billy that Sfath, whom he had his first contacts with, was her grandfather. And Billy's very surprised by this. He didn't know that. He really never knew too much about Spath. But he was kind of surprised, and he says, yeah, Spath disappeared on my 16th birthday, and I always just assumed that he probably died. And she said, that's correct, he did, and that was her grandfather. He inquired about the unusual ship that Spath came in, because it looked like a pear to him. It was an unusual form. And she said, yes, this ship was a present to her grandfather, and it was from a race of people in Sirius. Apparently in the Sirius area, there are they have two planets there that inhabit human life. On her 64th contact, which is Saturday, October 2nd, 1976, Billy's decided pretty much he's not going to go public, and he's explaining this to his group. He just can't get himself to do it. He's very frustrated about all the negative thinking that's pushed out against him whenever he tries to go public. He made a couple of attempts to show slides and show people. He's offered his reports to numerous authors, writers, and UFO people. Instead, for the most part, they seem very opinionated and aren't really open to his thinking, and they don't believe him. They make fun of him. So he's finding that this really isn't getting anywhere. A lot of people are hearing about it. He's getting a lot of publicity in the newspapers and magazines and on radio. Some of it okay. Hardly any of it is positive. Most everybody's calling him crazy and a lunatic and so forth, so he's really kind of giving up on the idea. And Semyasi has a talk with him and says, well, she's trying to build him up again, how important the mission is and how important he is to the future of the Earth itself, and that he is a great prophet, and it's important that he get all this information out. And Billy's just exhausted with it. He's having a lot of trouble with his family. There's a lot of pressure on him from his wife and his family and his friends. He still lives in Hinville, Switzerland, and he's having a lot of trouble with the townsfolk. So things are very difficult for him. Well, Semyasi tells him at that point that they're very interested in him going and taking this to the public, and they're pleased that at least so much information has gotten out so far, because they want to examine our reality. They're openly admitting now and starting to admit to Billy they really don't understand too much about our cause and effect, that they're not real sure how we're going to react to things all the time. They don't seem to be very tuned into our logic. You know, us little earthworms down here, we have our own way of doing things and solving problems, and the Pleiadians don't seem to be tuned in very well to that, and now they're telling Billy that a lot of what they've been doing is pushing Billy to go public almost as an experiment. They wanted to see, for one, if Billy would actually go through with it, and what the public would really think of it. They're very interested in trying to see if the information would go worldwide, because they want to look at the responses of the people to see if mass consciousness can actually be stimulated. They say apparently they're forbidden to actually one-on-one get into our innermost thoughts. They can't sample our independent thoughts. It's like an ethics thing with them. But they can, and apparently they were, through Billy, trying to impose their will a little bit on the mass consciousness of the public to see if that might be possible. And they're mentioning to Billy that they're it's kind of important to them that they find this out by 1977, and they're not telling him why 1977 is very important. But she tells Billy that they're regarding him actually as a success, because the information is getting out. There's a lot of coverage on it. The pictures are causing quite a stir. Most people have, in Europe, the few people that have seen his report notes don't agree with it, and are voicing a lot of objections to some of his numbers and his philosophies and so forth that are stated in these contact notes. But the pictures seem to be making inroads into governments and different organizations who are taking it seriously. So the Pleiadians were very pleased about that, in that the Billy's UFO contacts have made more impact than all the UFO groups have had over the years. And that's kind of true. Billy's probably more well-known than all the UFO groups anywhere. More people know about the Billy Meyer UFO case all around the world than any other UFO case. Billy's also apparently looks kind of like been a test case. They've been watching the probability that Billy himself would be able to keep going on his mission without acting against them. Apparently they've had problems with that in the past, but those that they've selected have not turned out to be very loyal and sincere. And they said there's a 34% chance that he would have acted against their wishes, and caused the mission to fail. But Billy's not done that so far. He's hung in there real well. So they were very proud about that, and they were very happy about it. So they are doing kind of their own little lab testing, and it's becoming more and more apparent that Billy and his group, apparently, and all of us, are something of an experiment, really, for the Pleiadians. That's probably the main reason why they don't land on the White House lawn and show themselves in force. They don't have any intention of doing that. And thank you, I'm glad that they don't. This is our planet, after all, and we have to solve our own problems. I mean, it's fascinating to see a ship and think about maybe going for a ride in one, but I really don't want to race from a long ways away with a different morality and a different sense of ethics telling us what to do or imposing their will on our society. And you know, if they let the ships be seen all over the world, that it's going to cause a lot of panic. Many people are going to worship them. A lot of other people are going to take everything they say totally serious. And that's going to really impede, terribly impede, the ability for us to build our own future. We have to learn to be responsible for ourselves. We really don't need no babysitters. So this is my planet. Stay off of it. Okay. On our 65th contact, which is October 23rd, 76, they reiterate a little bit that they're happy with the way things are going and that they don't want Bill any longer to worry about going public. As a matter of fact, now they've got a new attitude, and they want him to start protecting himself because now they're saying that so many people are finding out about it that there are many groups out there wishing to cause Billy harm, and there will be more attempts on his life. So they're telling him to be very careful, and he has a nice long talk with Ptah that day about now staying at home, don't venture too far from home, cancel speaking engagements, stay close, and we'll start watching his security and be very careful. That there are also others out there still trying to bring harm to him, so he's going to have to start watching it. From now on, his message should only be for small groups, and he should look to very serious-minded small groups to get his information out, and let the information from the contact notes start being disseminated in this fashion. One of their main worries, he says, remember earlier we talked about a group of people under Untenberg, and these were people that had flying discs. Ptah again tells him that there are private groups who have flying discs, not governments, but flying private groups that have built their own flying ships, and from the plans from World War II, and they're afraid that Billy will expose them. They've been very secretive for years, hiding out, and they're having their own effect on the world, and they're hoping to grow in power themselves and start to overtake the world or whatever. A man named Dunberg, who is a German, heads the Brazilian group, and they're after Billy. They're trying to kidnap Billy, and there's been three attempts by them on Billy's life. So they're telling Billy to start staying close to home and don't get out. On the 66th contact, Wednesday, November 10th, 76, a nice thing happens. Herbert Runkle gives Semyasi a teddy bear. And Billy brings it to the contact, and it's in a little box, and she opens it up, and it's a cuddly little teddy bear, and she just loves it. She thinks it's really cute, and normally she will not accept any gifts, but she likes this, and she takes the teddy bear. So somewhere out in the cosmos, there's a speeding beam ship flying along with a little teddy bear sitting on the dashboard. There was a comment about our astrology not being accurate enough, that we round things off too much to the minute, sometimes to the hour, when we should learn to be more accurate by the seconds, and we probably will once our technology advances. Once we're able to sense radiations from planets more accurately and do it, you know, scientifically, then astrology will probably pick up. She did mention how important it is at the birth, that the moment of birth isn't when the body comes out. The moment of birth is at the point which with the head, the soft spot on the head, actually first breaches the air and the radiations immediately hit the head. So it can sometimes be minutes or afterwards before the body actually comes out, and they felt that was very, very important. The symbol of Era, which I'll draw for you on the exhibit drawings, you can see, looks kind of like a right parentheses and a zero with a dot in the middle and then like, kind of like a plus sign over an E. This is the symbol of the planet Era. And Semyasi mentioned that the symbols of her planet and most all the other planets go back to their forefathers who created all these images based on the radiations of the stars. That there's a whole set of symbols and our current day astrology is still centered around most of those, that most of those images have worked away for down now for 12,000 years and are still found here on Earth. Semyasi is praising the members of Billy's group for helping him with security. There's three more attempts on his life, one by a group of Israelis, the same group apparently who killed the man who brought the Talmud Emmanuel to Billy. Now, there'll be a little bit more on that later on. But there's an attempt on his life by the Israelis, and there are two more attempts on his life by a Nazi group, which is hiding out in Brazil, that has their own flying disc. They're after Billy also. Apparently, this group in Brazil had a flying disc based on the knowledge from the Germans after World War II. They also had a captured extraterrestrial disc, which the Pleiadians found out about and destroyed so they would no longer have the use of. One other little interesting thing here, when Billy was taking a ride with Semyasi once and being able to take pictures of Venus and Mercury and so forth, she had mentioned something strange about the size of Mercury. And Billy asked her to reiterate that, and she said yes, that the core of Mercury is a metal core, and it has so much mass to it that it's actually pulling the surface in. Mercury is actually shrinking somewhat in size. Okay. Next thing we're going to get into is the pictures taken by Billy of the universe barrier and Jupiter. He was having a lot of problems, actually, with those. People were claiming that they were fakes that he had taken. I was telling you that Billy had taken some pictures of the barrier between universes when he was able to take a ride with Semyasi on the Great Spacer ship. What had happened is he'd released those pictures. They'd been out in a couple of magazines, and it kind of backfired on him, where all of a sudden, the middle of the summer in 76, articles are appearing that Billy Meyer's a fake, because this picture he took is the same as a picture that appeared in a drawing by NASA, or a scientist from NASA, and they're claiming that Billy had taken a picture of this drawing. Well, unfortunately, what had happened was no one really paid much attention to the fact that the drawing that he's supposed to have taken a picture of came out in the summer of 76, when in effect Billy took the pictures almost a year before that, back in 1975, in the spring of 75, when he went on the ride on the Great Spacer. But he doesn't have any proof of what day the picture was taken other than his contact notes. Unfortunately, a slide of film, the ones that he took, there was no date on there, and he really couldn't prove it. And he says even if he could, there was a date on part of the roll of the film. But no one was really believing him, and he was very frustrated that the media would actually do that. And he was pointing out some differences, too, where in his picture, that it differs from the drawing, where the some of the images are different, that the Great Barrier actually was an oval, and in the drawing it's a circle. And that in the drawing, there's a what looks to be like a village or a town below the big hole. And in Billy's picture, it's slightly different. So if you look closely, you can see that they're really not exactly the same. One is kind of a caricature of the other, it looks like. So Billy's very frustrated by this. Also, someone is questioning Billy's contact notes. They're saying that the writings of Semyasi, the things that she says, sound exactly like the way Billy talks. And they're questioning, you know, whether or not Billy's just making all this up. Well, Billy's discussing this with Semyasi because people don't understand exactly how the contact notes were created. When Billy goes home and the contact notes are transmitted to him via a device on the ship, it doesn't come through in language. What actually happens is the device on the ship goes into the subconscious of Semyasi, reads the thoughts, transmits the thoughts to Billy, but they come through to Billy, as symbols. Billy, long ago when he was young, was taught this symbol language that's used by the spirit, and it's used in telepathy. And their machines on board the ship transmit like it's telepathy. So Billy receives all of this. He writes down all these images and shapes, and then he converts them to language. So because he is converting them, he's writing down, he's expressing in his own views what Semyasi said and what he said. So the actual writings, the actual sentences and choice of adjectives and words and everything in the contact notes is all Billy's on both sides. Okay? That's why. We're not reading and listening to the actual words and feelings of Semyasi. It's actually Billy's interpretation of that. So there's a little difference there. So he thought, well, people aren't going to understand that anyway. They won't believe that that's even possible. So he's getting even a little more frustrated with the entire problem here of being a great prophet. Okay, we're moving up to the 69th contact now, which is Friday, December 10th, 1976. So we're getting close now to 2 years of contacts here. Billy had a question about Easter Island. It's one of the great mysteries here on Earth that's have gone unexplained over the years. If you're not familiar with Easter Island, you may have seen it on some television shows. It's that unusual island out in the ocean that has all these statues of very tall, large people on it that were carved out of some sort of hard stone. It's very difficult to wonder how that may be possible, and there's no explanation. Well, Billy wanted to know what was the secret there of Easter Island. And she says, well, it is a bit unusual. She wanted to remind him that it's been about 13,000 years since the last big colonization of extraterrestrials were actually here. It was during that time period we were coming to the end of the Atlantis move period, just before their Great War. She says there was a semi-Ishwish leader named Viracocha, if I pronounced that right. And he was kind of a greedy, bloodthirsty type, and he liked to set himself up as a true Ishwish, a true god or king of wisdom to the local people. He had the advantage of being very, very tall. He was a Lyrian, and he and his followers were around 11 meters tall, which puts them at 30 to 35 feet tall. So they're very big, and to the then-developing Earth human beings, I suppose they could pretty much have their own way and do whatever they want. He was actually quite cruel, kind of a dictator type. And he and his followers took over the city of Tiwanaku, which is about 4,000 meters high. It's a city high up in the mountains. They took that over as well as they took over the island, which we now call Easter Island. He then settled with his guards, called the Cherubs or Cherubims, on an isle called Mot. It became called Mot because Mot was the word in the old language that meant birds. And his guards, so to speak, around him were like these bird-like creatures that protected him. So a rather strange-looking lot here of 11-meter-tall Lyrians protected by bird-like creatures called cherubs. They settled his spot of rule, as I say, on the island of Mot. And that's where he kind of controlled his little kingdom. Well, the local people that were living there on Easter Island were trained in the use of the high technologies that these Lyrians had. And this is how they came about to build these great stone statues that are there. The Lyrians provided them with their high-tech tools, and the a society started flourishing there for a period of time. The locals then, in tribute to these great gods who brought them all this wonderment and so forth, begin to create these statues primitive people will do to worship their gods. The statues were made out of the stones from the lava walls that were nearby. Well, what happened was, she says, a plague of some kind hit the giants, and they fled the earth, leaving and taking all of their technology behind with them. They're not sure exactly what happened to them. It's believed that because of the illness, they may quite possibly have died in their ships just out in the free space, causing their ships to just wander aimlessly or crash into a sun or a star system or something. They think that's probably the best possibility of what happened. Because there, after they left, there was no indication of whatever happened to them after that. The locals that were left behind suddenly found themselves without leadership and without technology. They were just left. So in order to try to get their gods to come back to take care of them and again take care of their lives, they thought it would be a good idea to finish the statues and pay tribute again to these gods and hope that they would come back. Well, they didn't have the technology that they had before to build them, so they had to just finish the ones that they had already made. And they didn't actually finish them. That's the wrong word. What they did was they went to the lava pits and got some red earth and fashioned hats out of this red earth, and put them on the statues that they'd already built, hoping that would appease the gods so they might come back. It's really quite unexplainable why they decided on putting hats on the statues, but they did. Apparently, Viracocha, during his reign sometime, somehow news or word of his reign and his civilization here on Earth became known to a race of people in the Andromeda constellation, not the Andromeda galaxy. So in the Andromeda constellation, a small group of people knowing about this, they came to Earth 2,568 years ago. And they apparently landed in a similar area, knowing of Kokoha's reign. They were there for about 20 years. And they were the people who, actually they built up a pretty big society down there in South America. And they were the people who founded actually electrical current and electrical energy. And to build these cities up, they used these energy centers with cables under the ground. And when you see the lines of Nazca and so forth down there, these lines that are under the ground, they built those. Those are half-tube channels, Semyasi calls them, which she says, remarkably, no one understands them today. And what they are, there are tubes below the ground that carried electrical current somehow to provide to the the people of the times, and that was built by these beings from the Andromeda constellation. After about 20 years, though, apparently, they somehow were stricken with the same sort of illness they believed that the earlier Viracocha followers were, and they also fled. They're not sure about the illness, but it's kind of unusual in that area that both these ET groups would come down with some sort of illness which would force them to leave. Okay, there was a splinter group of the Hyperboreans. We talked about the Hyperboreans once before, who lived in the Greenland area. And these were giants. They colonized all of the different continents of the planet. Because Billy had a question about Greek mythology, the large people, the Cyclops, the Titans, and some of the dwarfs like Hercules. I mean, dwarfs like Hercules, but dwarfs and Titans like Hercules. And she said, yes, these were primarily people descendants of the Hyperboreans. And then quite a few of them were very large. Hercules was 3 meters tall. A meter now is roughly just a little bit more than 3 feet. It's like 3 feet and an inch. So when you can round all these meters off, just multiply them by three, and that would give you a rough idea of the footage. Hercules then was about 9 feet tall. Noah was about 3 meters 10 high. So he would be probably around 11 feet tall, something like that. Adam, when he was created by Semyasa, the science leader, he was about almost 5 meters tall. So he was somewhere around 14, 15 feet tall. Gilgamesh, the Sumerian god, was very tall, 7.5 meters. So we're looking at over 20 feet tall here. The giants of the yesteryear, though, they, after staying on Earth for a while and breeding, they slowly degenerated themselves down in size. So even though many of these great tall titans had bred themselves in with the Earth people, that the Earth genetic slowly degenerated the size of the people as well the planet itself. Because the atmospheric pressure on a planet and the sun have a lot to do with the size that you're going to grow here. Because that affects, of course, the pull on the bones and so forth, how strong your bones can build and how big you can be. So after a period of time, even these giants of yesteryear, their offspring degenerated down just to being the size that was in accordance with the size of the planet. There was a question about a person's name. Like Billy wanted to know, if a person's name, how it is chosen and is it important? And she said, yes, it is, that a person's name should reflect several things. One, his knowledge and his abilities, as well his level of evolution. If not, if a person is bearing a name that is not right for them, it can cause confusion in their life. Interesting idea, huh? As an observant, she pointed out that one of the people in Billy's group, Jacobus, whose name is Jacob, she says, here's a man with a particular problem because that's the wrong name for him. Because of that, it creates confusion. He overburdens himself with thoughts on dangerous ideas which are not normally characteristic for him. And they give trace of that to the name. She says, for instance, Edward means preserver of the treasure in the old language. By the way, this old language they refer to is the language they figured out that within all spirit forms of the universe, this symbol language that Billy uses all the time, it's a very accurate language where the symbols actually portray the true meaning of what things mean to the spirit. You know, we have words like tree, car, milk, run, and, this language that we've made up called English. But the sound of these words, these phrases and the sounds are different to the spirit. The spirit doesn't hear them very accurately. And quite often there can be some confusion between the sounds that you make and the way that the spirit actually interprets them. So the ancient Lyrians had figured out the actual sounds of words and what they really mean to your spiritual self. And I have a book, by the way, of names that Billy gave me. There's thousands of names in there with the sounds, how you say the words, and what the meaning actually means to your spirit. So when she's saying Edward means preserver of the treasure, that's what she's referring to. When you say the sounds, Edward, the sound of that phrase to your spirit means preserver of the treasure, and that was the basis for this old Lyrian language that she's talking about. Semyasi, her name means Semi-Ishwish. And Ishwish, to reiterate, means king of wisdom or god of all knowledge. And she's halfway through the studies or halfway through the evolution of becoming an Ishwish, so she's a Semi-Ishwish. And Semi in their language is E-L-O, so Elo. And a female Ishwish is called an Ishrish, I-S-H-R-I-S-H. So, in effect, Semyasi is an Elo Ishrish, is how they would pronounce it in her language. So, her name really isn't Semyasi. This is a name that she's using for these contacts. But on her world, she would be referred to as Elo Ishrish. When you hear people channeling all the time and claiming to be channeling Pleiadians and so forth, and you wish to challenge them a little bit to find out if they're really in touch with Pleiadians, you could find out if they know this. If they know anything at all about Pleiadian worlds, then they would understand this concept of language, and they would understand then exactly what these people, what their real names are, and how, because they don't call each other like Semyasi and Ptah on their planet. They refer to them by their level of knowledge, education, and spiritual evolution. Another question was about the size of our galaxy that we're in. Billy was curious because astronomers say that our galaxy, the Milky Way, the spiral galaxy that we live in, they estimate that it's about 30,000 light years to the center of our galaxy. Semyasi commented that not exactly right, that our instruments are not that accurate yet. That actually to the center of the galaxy of the Milky Way, as measured from our Sol system, from our sun, would be 53,000 light years. Now we're out kind of on the edge, the suburbs here of our galaxy. But if it's 53,000 light years to the center of our galaxy, that's at least 116,000 light years across, plus we're not clear at the edge. So the Milky Way galaxy could easily be in excess of 125,000 light years across it. If you're not into mathematics, and if that doesn't mean anything to you, imagine it like this. A light year is expressed, it's the basic theoretical idea of the distance that light will travel in 1 year. Say, for instance, you went out on a starry night with your flashlight, and you hit the button and flicked your flashlight on. A light immediately leaves your flashlight, doesn't it? It would circle around the planet, if it could, you know, go in that direction, for instance, 7 times in 1 second. Because light travels at 186,000 miles in 1 second. Now, we're used to thinking of things in terms of miles per hour. Okay, if you get in your car and go down the freeway, it's 55 miles in 1 hour you may be driving. Well, here, light's going 186,000 miles, 7 times around the Earth, in 1 second. Now, here's what a light year is. If light travels at 186,000 miles in 1 second, it takes 60 seconds to make a minute, doesn't it? So multiply 60 times 186,000, and that's how far light will go in 1 minute. Well, now it takes, 60 minutes to make an hour. So take 60 times that number, and that's how far light will travel in 1 hour. Okay? That's only 1 hour. Now there's 24 hours in a day. So multiply that number times 24, and you've got how far light will travel in a day. Well, that's just 1 day. Now multiply that number times 365, because we have 365 days in a year. Now you got a huge number, and that's how far light will travel in 1 year. Consequently, that is a light year. Now they're telling us that it's 53,000 times that, 53,000 of these light years to get to the center of our galaxy. So we have just a fantastically huge number here. So, living on our little planet with our primitive devices, our cars, and our airplanes, distance relative to the size of the galaxy is way off. We have no concept. And that's just inside of our galaxy. Our galaxy then may perhaps be around 125,000, 130,000 light years across it in diameter. But then once we leave our galaxy out into free space, there are billions and billions of galaxies. We have no concept of the idea or the size of the actual universe itself. So I don't think that you could even express it in light years. Probably if you shot a beam of light from our galaxy in a particular direction, if it would continue on forever, it could be countless billions and billions of light years before it would ever even reach, you know, any sort of edge to our universe. And again, an edge doesn't exist because it seems to be in a spiral type shape. Okay, Billy is led out to a spot telepathically by Semyasi where he sees a hole burned in the ground where it looks like a saucer has landed. It's about 4 meters in diameter. And they're also around the center hole. It looks like there's about four other landing tracks where it looks like the landing gear of a ship may have set down. But it doesn't look like a landing tracks from the Pleiadian beam ships. Also, he starts looking around. It's in the snow around the ship. And he finds footprints leading away from the ship, one of them leading down to a stream and coming back. He finds some footprints that disappear off into the forest and come back. One set of footprints have no trail at all. Just a few meters, about 100 meters away from the ship, there's just one set of footprints in the snow with no trail leading. So how does someone make footprints in the snow with no trail? Looks like they just popped right out of the air and stood down in the snow and then disappeared. Semyasi explains that there was a very small dwarf race who became lost in time and came into the Earth atmosphere. They had set down there, finding themselves in a rather strange place. They decided to collect some samples and try to figure out where they were. And the footprints that Billy has seen is these little dwarf beings going out to collect samples in the trees and in the water and so forth to ascertain more about the planet. The unusual set of footprints where there was just one footprint in the snow far away from the ship, she said that while two or three of the dwarfs were out collecting samples, that one of them was kind of posted as a sentry, and he was floating or flying around in the air, and at one particular spot he came too close to the ground and actually sat down on the ground in the snow for a minute and then flew back up into the air. Apparently what had happened is that these were a race of people who were just developing time travel, and had made a mistake, an error in their calculations, and had greatly slipped out of time when they were in hyperspace and found themselves on Earth way out of their own time frame. Semyasi remarked that Ptah would help them, that he would make some efforts to find out where their galaxy was, and then he could return them in his own ship, he could return them back to their own time. That would be possible. Normally, if you're in a ship on your own, and you go into hyperspace, and you vary the speed of your particles, like we talked about earlier. If you lower that speed too much and there's too much variance, remember, you'll slip in time billions of years and you're going to have almost an impossible time ever finding your way back. So here's a situation where that actually happened. On the 70th contact, which was on Thursday, January 6, 77, here we're almost up to an anniversary contact, because Billy's contact started on January 28, 75, so we're almost 2 years now into the contacts, and we've had 70 of them. Billy had some questions about atoms and molecules. He'd remembered that Semyasi at one point had told him there was some molecule that had 49 atoms in it, and he wanted a lengthier explanation about what that was. She said, well, that's the most unusual molecule, because when spiritual energy is formed, that the first molecule, the first primary steps and beginning of formation of spiritual energy is a molecule formed of 49 atoms in it. Now, the atom itself, she said, is not pure material. Our scientists are still thinking of it as all coarse matter, that an atom is completely solid matter, but it is not. She said that an atom is actually a crossover, and the crossover was the phrase they used, that an atom is a crossover between material matter and spiritual energy. That both things go into comprising an atom, but our scientists have not discovered that yet. Atoms can be explained, she said, in sevens. The Pleiadians call it the sevens of the synthesis of matter. That atoms actually have seven planes to them. Currently, our science seems to be aware of two levels, in other words, two breakdowns of what is inside of an atom. There are seven levels. The seventh and the sixth level, she says, are now aware to our science, that we've figured out the seventh level of what's inside of an atom. And we've even got become some aware of the sixth plane, which is composed of elementary particles. But she says, at least as of 1977 here, that our scientists currently are confused by the fifth plane. It's a mystery. Now, we're up in 92 now, so I don't know how we may have advanced in those areas. But she says they also have to discover that there are four more planes down, four more different levels breaking an atom down as you go smaller and smaller into matter. There's also, aside from that, a microatomic plane besides the normal atom planes. So apparently there seem to be subdivisions of the atom which follow the same premise that the universe does, breaking sevens down into sevens. She says, but mainly what has to be discerned as we move along is that atoms and matter are not the only thing. This is where we actually discover technically what spiritual energy is when we start breaking down the atoms. Well, Billy wants to play a joke on his friends, and after this contact comes to an end, he says sees on the screens that his friends are waiting for him down in the coal down below. They've had to drive about 20 miles from home, actually 20 kilometers, it says. These Europeans and their metrics. He's about 20 kilometers away from his home, and he wants to play a little joke on his friends. So he asked Semyasi if she could set him down in a field close to home, back close to home, so he wouldn't have to go so far. And he would call on the radio and let his friends know where he's at so they could come and pick him up. Well, he does that. And Semyasi takes him back close to his home, sets him down in a snowy field, in the middle of a field with snow, and he calls his friends on the radio. Well, they come to get him, and not only are they kind of surprised somehow that he could get back the 20 kilometers back to home, but how did he wind up out in the middle of this field with no tracks out to where he's standing? So he quite often did this and had a little fun with them. On Billy's birthday, which was February 3rd, 1977, was his 72nd contact. By the way, that's his birthday where he turns 40 years old on that birthday. It was at this particular occasion that Semyasi again reiterated to Billy that it's time to move out of Hinville. Hinville is H-I-N-W-E-L. And this is where Billy's lived for a long period of time, and he's been living there so far all through the contacts. But she's telling him that it's time for him to move, time for him to find a new place. And she says she shows him a map to help him decide where it is that he should move. On this, it's not actually a map. Billy has a map with him of Switzerland, and inside of the ship on one of the side screens, she is showing him the different locations in Europe and the problems that are going to arise in the next few years, which should dictate where he moves. And she's showing him on the screen, says, here's an area where there's going to be a lot of very strong earthquake activity. You don't want to move there. Here's an area where there's actually going to be a volcano uprise in Switzerland that's currently, apparently, we're not aware of at the moment, but there's going to be some sort of volcano in Switzerland which is going to erupt, causing a major loss of life. She says, along this flat zone in the northern part of Switzerland, you want to avoid this because it's going to be destroyed by fire during the coming war. Apparently, our next war, there's some new devices going to be used that set the atmosphere on fire. A lot of firestorms in the air burning the ground. It's interesting that an unrelated set of information, which comes from the Nostradamus papers, which many people have made their own versions of, that many of them agree that Nostradamus talks about the Chinese inventing new weapons that ignite the atmosphere and cause these firestorms also. So there might be some correlation here between Nostradamus' prediction of the Third World breaking out caused by the Chinese marching on Europe with firestorm devices and the Pleiadian prophecy saying that, yes, that there will be firestorms over Europe. And again, remember that she talks about, even in the 70s, that our American government is fooling around with devices which cause chain reaction in the air and ignite the atmosphere and burn the planet. That was one of the main things that they were very concerned about always. She shows him four areas that are very suitable. And one of the best, she says, is this area between where the volcano is going to happen and these particular earthquake zones. So she's pointing out to him, you know, where to look to move. Well, Billy says that's great. He's very interested in building a center where he and the others could live and have their own way of life. But where's the money going to come from for this? Semyasi tells Billy not to worry, that she will send out telepathic thoughts to those people in Billy's group about the truth of the mission. And she says she doesn't call this coercion. She believes that just sending out thoughts, is not coercion. But on the one side, she may be correct, because she says they won't know where the thoughts will come from. The thoughts will seem like their own ideas, and they can draw their own conclusions from the ideas she's going to send them, and that they will help Billy get this center. And then she goes on to explain that many of the group members that have already come to follow around Billy will be incarnated in their next life to help Billy out again. That Billy, who already knows that he was going to have 6 more lifetimes in the next 800 years, which are going to be very rapid lifetimes in different places on the planet to fulfill his mission, she says that this center that they're about to get, this place, this home, will become one of the main centers for spiritual growth on the planet, and that many of the people involved with Billy right now are very special people that will be incarnated actually right back at the center. And then she goes on to say that some of them will be reborn again between the years 2015 and 2025. A couple others will be born between 2033 and 2036. And the last ones will be born again between 2045 and 2072. It's very important, she says, that they incarnate again quickly. That normally the turnaround time during normal times is about 152 years for a spirit to come back into body when it leads a long and fulfilled life. She says, however, the incarnation period for these people is going to be kind of, I guess you could say they're going to mingle with it. And they're going to procreate them or cause them to be born faster, because these are difficult times where it is important that there are these people are born again quickly to help with the education of the earth. Then she begins to put names to Billy of the people who are going to be born, reborn at the center. She also tells him which sex they're going to be. And the ones that are not going to be born at the center, of which several would also be born at different places in the European theater, a couple of them several thousand kilometers away. So Billy's kind of a little surprised at this, because he was not aware of all of this. But he says that it's very important that also that these people understand this and know that normally individuals have no say-so in where they are incarnated at physically, because they don't know how to do it. It is possible for an individual to have some control over that. But in this case, these people are being told that they are very special people to the mission of Earth, and that they can be incarnated again at a specific time and place to continue on with their mission, and that they will continue to be evolved with the Pleiadians throughout these missions. Billy will be incarnated somewhere else, not in Switzerland, his next life. He will die a unexpected death, which will become a surprise to everyone. And this might be done on purpose, or perhaps even with the help of the Pleiadians, so to facilitate him being born quicker. Because if you die by accident and do not fulfill your normal lifespan, you come back faster. So they may be doing this on purpose, because Billy is to have 6 lifetimes in 800 years, which is very quick turnaround time, much faster than normal. They don't want to give tell Billy the exact dates of his death, because they don't want anybody to know that, although he has kind of an idea. But they don't want the people around him to know that, because they're afraid that he might be taken as an idol or martyred or something. It'll be 800 years before he personally will be rejoined with the innermost group that he's putting together here. But these people themselves, the group will go on, and at the center where they're getting ready to build. So she felt it's very important that they know this, and how important it is that they all contribute to the center. Billy said he was aware of the ability that human beings have to actually have some control over where they're going to be incarnated next. That in his travels when he was younger in the Himalayas, he had spoken with some real masters who really understood these things, and they had told him at the time how that was possible. Well, the 73rd contact was on Monday, February 7th, just a few days after that. And Billy's very excited. They've had a meeting of the group, and he suddenly flashed, like he said. He had this memory of someone that had a house about a year before that. He had remembered this. It just popped into his head that there was this home in a place called Schmidruti that he had known about a year ago, and suddenly called the man, and the timing was great that this man said, sure, the house is going to be available next week, and it's going on the market to be sold. And it was one of these locations that Billy had always thought would be really great to have a center at. And he was very excited that it just seemed to fall right in place. Well, Semyonovsky says, well, didn't exactly fall in place, that she'd had a little bit to do with that, that she knew it was the right place, and she already knew in the future that that would actually be the location, but she wanted to leave it up to Billy to make the final decisions. She didn't want to interfere in his free will. But what she had done was, Billy didn't exactly get the idea to call this man back on his own, that she had brought that old memory to the forefront of his conscious mind so he would remember to do it. So it was his own initiative that actually called the man and so forth, and to find out about the house. But apparently the house was going to become available, and the group was very excited about it. And again, she reiterated the importance that the certain group members become aware of how important they were to the mission. Later on, it's not in the contact notes, but later on, Billy's even going to inform certain of the key members in the group of their past lives, how they've been involved with this mission to educate Earth in previous lives already and don't know it, and how their importance affects the spiritual growth of the planet Earth in the next few hundred years. So many of those people that are living over there right now are under the impression that they've had previous lives and will have more lives to come in connection with Billy and the Pleiadians. And that by living there at the center, they're becoming a member of, and the word elite was used, it says that if they continue on and help with the center, and that their incarnations will be controlled by the Pleiadians, where they will be reborn and pulled back together, and they will become members of what the Pleiadians called elite spiritual leaders to help in educating the Earth. Well, I emphasize that the word elite is in the contact notes because many people who've gone over to visit at the center have come away with the description of the people there that they seem to think that they're kind of an elitist group. And that's probably where this thinking comes from. The Pleiadians have told them that they are going to become that they are special incarnated spirits working on a mission. And they do have that attitude over there. They're not unkind. They're not cold to people. They are just into themselves. They're very busy with their mission. They take this very, very seriously. And to outsiders, when they come over there, especially even myself, my first time over, you do get that impression that we mistakenly think that they think they're better than other people, and that's not the case. They just like to keep to themselves and protect their own environment and protect their own thoughts. And they are very, very serious about the mission that they are on. You see, for all of these people, they have a different truth than the rest of the world does. All of these people have had contacts mentally, telepathically. They've been out to see the ships physically. To them, they know it's real. To UFO experts and investigators and people who look into this case around the world, they may look at fringe evidence and say, well, it's probably not true, or this is too exaggerated, or for whatever reason, they come to their own conclusions that Billy Meyer perhaps may be a fraud or a great hoax. And they make up some sort of evidence of their own to try to support their ideas. But to Billy and the people that are living over there, it's all very real. Because for them, they've all experienced it. It's their own truth. And they have knowledges, experiences, and so forth that the rest of us really aren't aware of. Semyonovsky goes on to explain to Billy that she already knows in the future that this is the home that they will get, and it's called Hinterschmidruti, because Schmidruti is a post office on the road right there. That's where you write to when you write to Billy, and he lives behind the post office. So in the German language, Hinter means behind, so he lives in Hinterschmidruti, in other words, behind Schmidruti, behind the post office, which he does. It's a little road that just leads down into the forest right behind the post office there on the road that goes to that area, and that's where his home is. She tells him that it will be purchased in the early part of 78 in the spring, that the group members will buy it, and that Billy will be greatly surprised, which won't be any surprise anymore, of the difficulties, intrigues in the group when they actually try to come together to buy this place. And actually, that did happen. I don't have time here, and it's probably not even a good thing to talk about, but there were a lot of problems among all of the group members when they actually sat down to the kitchen table and started getting the money together to buy this place. And there are many great stories of intrigues among people and families getting irritated with one another. Many people left the group, and Billy alienated some people. And there were a lot of social problems among many members of the group when this came about, when they were all going together to form this little center that they live at. There's 15 people live there now. There's 25 people in what's called the Kern Group, the center group. Of people that pay for and own this home. Well, Billy's in the ship on his radio, and they're over the city of Kloten, which is a suburb of Zurich. There's an airport there. And he sees, he's got his radio with him. He's got his little two-way radio with him, and he's trying to get in touch with Jacobus, who is down in the car, and he can see Jacobus on the ground. And he asks him, Yossi, if Jacobus can see the ship. And she says, no, probably not very well, that it's being screened, but she can let it be seen a little bit. And so he calls out to Jacobus on the radio. Jacobus doesn't answer. And she says, well, I've told you before that when the ship's screens are on, it also blocks energies from going out, and your radio signals can't get through the screen. So and then she fixes it somehow, and she connects his radio to something in the ship so his radio can actually, his signals can get through the screens. Jacobus hears Billy. And he responds, no, I can barely see the ship. It looks like a shimmering light kind of in the sky, but I can't make it out very well. So Billy turns to Semyasi and says, let Jacobus see the ship. So she does. She drops the screens just for a few seconds, and quite quickly Jacobus responds, yes, yes, I can see the ship. And it was just hanging in the air in front of him up in the air. So he was very excited. So for him, Jacobus, here was his truth. He finally got to see exactly the ship in broad daylight and know for himself that it was real also. So he has his own truth. Billy says, well, let's play a little joke on Jacobus here. And when you let me down right in front of the car to kind of startle him. I'll just appear suddenly in front of the car. And she says, well, I can do even better than that. I can fix it so when you materialize, you will materialize from the ground up. And it will look like you just came popping right up out of the ground. And he says, that's great. That's exactly the effect I'm after. He wants to shock Jacobus. So he does, and he appears. He just springs right up in front of the car suddenly, and it really gives Jacobus a shake. And Jacobus later goes on to write like a two-page little article about his experiences that day seeing the ship, and he describes how he has to put up with the tomfoolery and the jokes of Billy when he springs up in front of the car. Billy did this for Elsa and Bernadette and several others. He's always trying to trick them. But over the period of time, over the course of these contacts, all of his special members and close members of the group all got to see the ship at one time or the other. All received telepathic messages from Semyasi. Many of them have their own shoeboxes full of pictures that they took on their own in broad daylight also. So anyone who thinks the ships are not real or there is not supporting evidence, all you really need to do is talk to these people. There are a number of them over there who have all shared in this experience. And this is another reason why they keep to themselves. Okay, we're up to the 75th contact, which was on Monday, February 21st, 1977. Billy says to Semyasi, something kind of unusual happened. They were out at the new house that they haven't moved into yet. They're out at the new house, getting excited, looking it over, before it goes through escrow. Or we have escrows in California. I don't know what they have in Switzerland, but, they're getting the money together to buy the house, and they've made a down payment, apparently, and they're waiting for the paperwork to close and the house become their own, and they're out looking at it. And Billy notices in the basement, which was full of water, that the water now is disappearing, and he notices one small footprint where the water was, and it looks like the footprint of a child. And he calls out to Bernadette, who's with him, to get her camera and come take a picture, which she does. And Billy says, stand right here and take a picture to the area where that footprint is. Bernadette doesn't see anything. So she snaps the picture, and they're using a flashlight because they don't have any light down there. She doesn't have a flash. They take the picture. The picture is then developed, and Billy tells her to watch on the film because on the film she'll see something unusual, and she does. On the film, she sees a little dwarf being with a helmet on, and she's really surprised because she says, I couldn't see anything with my eyes. And he says, well, that the Semyasi had told him that there was a dwarf race that lives on one of the planets in the Pleiades. And these people have these unique special ability to mentally clean the air and to clean negative energies from objects and from fluids and so forth. And the Semyasi had asked them to come and clean the house of negative thoughts and negative influences in the wood and the water and the stone and the ground all around the area before they moved in, so it would be healthier and cleaner for them spiritually. And this little being was there doing that, and that he had he wore tape, what looked like tape, around his body to keep himself invisible, and it was invisible to our eyes, but the camera would pick it up. So we had this faint image on a picture by Bernadette of this little dwarf being helping spiritually clean up the house for them. So Bernadette, by the way, on that day when she took the picture, she was out there with Billy on this contact. She dropped him off, as well. Mr. Bert Singer, Sr. and Jr. and Engelbrecht Wachter were there also, Engelbert Wachter. And all four of them on that day got to see a display also, a demonstration they always called them. All four of them wrote up a little note then that's several pages in the contact notes about this particular contact where Semyasi allowed them also to see the ship in broad daylight hovering just in the air. So again, all four of these people are again having another contact in broad daylight, and they're receiving telepathic feelings and thoughts from Semyasi. So for them also, the experience is growing. For them also, they are contactees. For them also, they have their own truth. On the 76th contact, on Monday, May 23rd, 77, Billy has a meeting with Manera. And a couple of months have gone by. He hasn't seen Semyasi in 3 months. She's off doing something else. And he has a quick meeting with Manera, who is, you know, one of Semyasi's replacements. There was a lady named Manera, and she had a helper named Rala, R-A-L-A. And he explains, oh, gee, things have been pretty rough. We're having a lot of difficulties with the house and the people. And he explains all about that. Manera says she knows, but it's going to work out. Just patience. Put up with everything. And she searches Billy's thoughts and says she's very pleased to find that Billy is not prejudiced. That most Earth people, she says, are prejudiced. They just can't help it. They're raised that way. That they're raised, it's a control factor that they raise us so that we learn and can be controlled by hating color and so forth, in that way that power organizations can control us. And that's true. You know, if they can rile you up so you are against someone who has brown skin or blue skin or green skin or whatever it is, then you are easily controlled and you are falling to the whims of whoever is controlling you. Pictures of drawings in magazines, which is not true. So.